This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Imagine growing up in prison, spending decades there, and then suddenly finding yourself on the outside, a chance to start a new life, but in a world that is unfamiliar in many ways. You don't have skills or training. You do have a criminal record, which makes full integration, like finding a job, difficult. That's the challenge faced by so-called juvenile lifers who were sentenced to life in prison as teenagers but are now being released on parole. It follows decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court and the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court that found automatic life sentences for juveniles without the possibility of parole are unconstitutional. The result, over the past 2 years, 11 men have been paroled in Massachusetts. WBUR's Deborah Becker spent time with two of them, 52-year-old Greg Diachenko, who was convicted for fatally stabbing a man to death when he was 17, and 41-year-old Joe Donovan, who was sent to prison when he was 17 for killing an MIT student. In a moment, we'll talk to two experts about the challenges of re-entry faced by men like these. But first, let's listen to a brief excerpt from Deb's reporting.
Donovan is fighting his lifetime parole because he says he feels he served his sentence. He's also worried that it could make it easier for him to wind up back behind bars, even for a misunderstanding. Donovan says he stays away from crowds, so as much as he likes Fenway Park, he's declined an invitation to a Red Sox game.
There's just such a possibility of it turning in such a bad way, even an innocent situation. You know, I'm on paper as a murderer. If they look it up, right? If they run my name, it's a murderer out. And so, like, they're not going to look at the background story of, like, well, really, you know, he didn't do the crime of murder. The way they're going to look at it is he's a murderer out on parole.
Donovan and Diachenko have similar parole conditions. They must meet regularly with a parole officer and a counselor, pay monthly parole fees, and hold steady jobs. They're both still in awe that they've actually been let go from prison. And Diachenko gets emotional, remembering the people he knows who are still incarcerated.
I would like people to know on the inside that I think about them all the time. I don't want to get too emotional, but I think about my fellow lifers all the time. And hopefully...
Sorry, this
it's okay.
Is hard for you.
It is hard. And hopefully laws will change one day that will give them an opportunity to come out here in society and establish themselves and contribute.
Both Diachenko and Donovan say adjusting to their new lives would be near impossible without their strong family support. They also both say they deserved to be punished for their crimes, but they say because most inmates are released, even those who never thought they would be, a greater emphasis on rehabilitation would benefit everyone.
An excerpt there from WBUR's Deb Becker's series on Greg Diachenko and Joe Donovan, juvenile lifers who were sentenced to life in prison as teenagers but are now out on parole. And you can find the full two-part series at our website, WBUR.org. Joining us now in the studio is Josh Doan. He's the director of the Youth Advocacy Division of the Massachusetts Committee for Public Counsel Services. And Josh, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
I want to start with the implications of these important rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court and the SJC. You know, that automatic life sentences for people convicted as juveniles are unconstitutional. So people are now being released, people like Joe Donovan and Greg Diachenko. Are we ready as a society to make sure they have the best chance to succeed?
Well, I certainly think that some segments of society are ready. I think it's clear if you listen to the radio or you read the paper that there are people who are still in a lot of pain from the events, who are not able to let go of that anger and don't want anybody to get out. But the courts have been clear that the way to interpret our Constitution is that when people commit serious offenses when they are so young— that we have to give them another chance. We have to recognize that they were less culpable than had they done this when they were 30, and that they're likely to rehabilitate themselves. So we have to be ready. And there are people out there who are ready. So in some cases, there are families, which is really...
So you're talking about the families of the offenders, in other words.
The families of the offenders are the ones that are... So it's very helpful to them if their families are ready. Not everybody has a family that's capable.
Yeah,
But there are also organizations like SPAN, Straight Ahead Ministries. There are other places that are knowledgeable and ready to help.
And what are in terms of being ready to help? What do they need to help most with? In other words, what are some of the challenges that juvenile lifers face when they reenter society? I mean, it seems like if you've been out of society for a really long time, you just might not be equipped to reenter society, whether it's finding a job or whatever it is.
Well, you've hit it right on the head.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, right now, our Department of Correction is not doing enough to help people prepare for that transition. And I think we could also do a much better job with the parole board itself or the parole department in terms of their desire and ability to provide not just supervision, but also support.
Well, I want to ask you about that, about the role of the parole board. Both men that we just heard about are essentially subjected to lifetime parole. How does the parole system work in terms of how it supports parolees, or does it support parolees?
So, you know, parole departments change over time, like all institutions. And some of it depends on how well resourced they are at any given moment. But I would say, painting with a very broad brush, that currently what parolees experience is a parole department that is monitoring them fairly closely, but not providing support, so not helping them find a place to live. They may say to them, that place is not acceptable, that place is not acceptable, but they don't find a place. They don't help them to find a job. They don't provide them job training or counseling to learn how to function at the workplace. So in contrast to our probation service, for example, which, as you know, is under new leadership, not so new anymore, but a really visionary commissioner, where they've shifted everything they're doing to say, okay, we've got people out, we've got people on probation. How do we help them to succeed?
Well, I want to bring in another voice. I want to introduce Jim McCarthy because we're talking about the parole system. Jim McCarthy is a former Massachusetts State Parole Officer and the former supervisor of the Brockton Office of the Massachusetts Parole Board. And Jim McCarthy, it's great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
So I'd love it if I could start this way, if you could sort of explain from your perspective, from a parole officer's perspective, what the relationship between officer and parolee is, in particular when it comes to the kind of folks that we've been talking about.
Sure. It's very simple. A parole officer has a very professional responsibility to assist the offender in terms of the reintegration process, as well as protect the public. So it's a dual role, and I don't really see any conflict in that role. But the parole officers statewide, and I should add nationwide, they have a tough task, and that is to assist offenders in terms of the reentry process so they don't reoffend and so we don't have more crime victims out there.
Right. One of the things that one of the men that Deb Becker spoke to in her story told her was that he was very concerned about the risk of returning to prison, so much so that he's worried about essentially being nailed on a technicality, a technical violation of his parole. And he's so worried that he won't even go, for example, to a ball game at Fenway Park because he just sees the potential for getting into trouble and conflict there as so likely. Is that concern valid from your experience, or what's your response to him?
Well, for openness, I am a Red Sox fan, and I wouldn't discourage anybody from attending and supporting the Red Sox. I think this is the year they may go the distance. But that issue aside, Anthony, he may have some fears, but I don't think they're very accurate in terms of being fearful of crowds or being fearful of going out and being engaged in the community. As long as he's conducting himself as a responsible citizen and abiding by the parole conditions, he certainly has nothing to fear.
Let me ask you both, and I'll come back to Josh Doan for this question, but I'd love you to chime in as well, Jim McCarthy. Is the system set up to handle these types of parolees, guys who are now in their 50s, who essentially grew up in prison, to help them adjust? I mean, what's the element that's missing, Josh Doan?
So I guess if I were going to try and come up with a simple way to capture it,
yeah.
It's a support infrastructure. I would say there's also a philosophical gap. So I endorse everything that Jim said, including the Red Sox.
It's good. Glad we're all in agreement on that one.
where I think we disagree is that I think that, and I know lots of people on parole, that's my work, not just the lifers, and I think that their viewpoint is that they are much more likely to go back to prison on a technical violation than a new offense, and that they're not feeling that support. You know, guys like Joe Donovan, I thought that report this morning was terrific. They've got a family, you know, and that's what many of us rely on. And so that means that it helps them with a place to live. It helps them with somebody to talk to that may lead to connections for jobs. Guys that are coming out where that family is not so intact and maybe doesn't have a lot of resources, they don't have a place to live. They don't have somebody that helps them around the job stuff. We know that the people that come out of prison that have the lowest recidivism rates are people that are able to have a family, so not just have a kid scattered somewhere, but mm-hmm. be really part of a family, and are able to get and maintain meaningful employment.
Sure.
And so when you come out of prison and you grew up there and you don't have those job skills and you don't have a good way to make money, so it's hard for you to have a place to live, to get a job, it makes it a lot harder to also have a stable family situation. That shouldn't be the means that you can't make it. As a state, if as Jim said, we want to protect public safety, then we need to provide a little bit more of a support network for those guys. It doesn't take much to help them succeed.
All right, Jim McCarthy, I want to give the last word to you. We're sort of up against the clock here, but Jim, respond to that idea of the need for a little bit more support for these folks. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree that many of these folks leaving prison need a lot of assistance, need a lot of support. Community and family support is certainly essential. I think the parole officers provide that support. They're very positive in terms of how they deal with offenders across the state. They're very proactive in terms of dealing with offenders across the state. What would help many offenders leaving prison is if they left from lower security, from pre-release, where they have the opportunity to gradually earn their freedom and to get engaged in the employment activities and counseling activities while they're still technically under correctional supervision. So I certainly agree with Josh, and I certainly agree with yourself. A lot of these offenders have been locked up for a long time, and they need all the support we can certainly give them. And it's to everybody's benefit if they get that support. But I'll tell you, I think the parole board does a pretty good job in terms of assisting offenders.
All right.
Parole officers across the state, they act as resource brokers. They conduct a needs assessment, a risk assessment, and they refer all of these offenders to the appropriate agencies to address those needs.
All right, Jim McCarthy, we're going to have to leave it there only because our time is up, but I'm really grateful for your participation today. That's Jim McCarthy. He's a former Massachusetts State Parole Officer, and Josh Doan is the Director of the Youth Advocacy Division for the Massachusetts Committee for Public Counsel Services. Josh, thank you as well for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, when hijackers crashed planes into the World Trade Center towers in New York, the Pentagon in Washington, and a field in Pennsylvania. Almost 3,000 people died on what began as a brilliant late summer day. Many of those people had ties to Massachusetts. And this week, we're remembering some of them by visiting the places that were important to them and to those they left behind. Today, it's Lake Cochituate in Framingham. That's where, back in 2011, we spoke to the daughters of Judy LaRocque. She was a passenger on American Airlines Flight 11 out of Boston.
My name is Danielle Lamack.
And I'm Carrie Lamack.
Mom grew up on Lake Cochituate, as did we, so she spent most of her life here. And this, to me, would be Mom's point where we would come. Really, throughout our lives, we always did things on Lake Cochituate, and this point became a really important part of her life, where she would oftentimes be with her dog, Naboo, and kind of find peace from the daily tolls of life, and could find herself and relax on a daily basis. She came out here at least twice a day, every day.
I think of some of the funny things, too, that happened here, like when we lost Naboo's ball down the hill, and you climbed, you fell down the hill trying to get it, and you tried to get it back up.
While there's a serenity to it, it's also our childhood, and it's swimming every day and playing on our rafts.
And a lot of the times we would just come in on walks with Mom and have those mother-daughter talks that you always want to be able to have, and we were so lucky that we had a relationship with Mom where we could have those kinds of talks all the time, and I feel like this place is symbolic to me of that.
Yeah, there's a closeness to Mom here that we always had during our life, and even when we weren't living in Framingham, any time we came back here, this is one of the first things we did, and we made sure we did it often.
Yeah.
I don't know why I feel like the spot we're in is, for me, my Wizard of Oz place. It's just, it's green everywhere, and the ground is carpeted with orange pine needles. Right now, it's the end of summer, so the trees are green, and the lake is very still. And I just look around, and I feel like I'm away from it all right now. We don't have her remains, but we have her in our hearts, and her spirit carries on through us, through my children, and this location is a place where we can really connect. We still feel her here.
Yeah.
Lake Cochituate in Framingham, in a memory of Judy LaRocque, a passenger on American Airlines Flight 11 who died in the 9/11 attacks 15 years ago. And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.